Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, we made it. We're done with Matt Powell. This is the last video in this series. Hopefully, I will never have to cover Powell again, and then you'll never have to see him on the channel again. Unless he actually accepts my invitation to join me for a live discussion at some point, but I'm not holding my breath for that. So, let's get it over with!
There's so much of a hurdle for us to get over because what we've done is we've made this generation of people that are ingrained into thinking in only one way.
So we've raised a generation according to biblical principles, getting them while they're young? Like, I could see Raw Matt being into some wooey New Age stuff as well as creationism based on what I've seen on rawmatt.com, which admittedly is not run by Matt by one of his fans. So is he of the opinion that young Earth creationism is just one aspect of a larger wooey worldview? That's what he seems to be saying here, but I doubt Matt Powell would approve of such a worldview.
And evolution is the only way that there is, and there's only one model.
Evolution is one aspect of one scientific area. It's a pretty major one, to be sure, but it's not like people live their lives based around evolutionary dictates. And there are multiple evolutionary models depending on which specific aspect of evolution we're looking at. Remember, evolution is a theory. In science, a theory is an entire body of facts, data, laws, and phenomena. There are always going to be areas of every theory that we don't entirely understand. And in these areas, there will be competing hypotheses used to explain how we think that area works, that is, different models. And in evolution, this is often the case. Hell, we just learned on Monday about the debate between the evolutionary origin of insect wings, and the two most prominent options were presented as a false dichotomy. That's two different models about how that part of evolution works. And they aren't the only two, they are just the two that are seen at the moment to be the most likely.
And there's only one explanation. There isn't. There are more explanations, and they can be answered now, and there's more than one model, and our model is so good, it's never been seen before this good.
Are you suggesting that creation is the good model? What do you mean, it's never been seen before this good, Sick? Creationism hasn't really changed since the 1960s. Every now and again, they think of a new argument to make, but for the most part, it's all just rephrasing of the same old arguments. The last new argument they got was in 2005 with the soft tissue discovery. But there are new discoveries made in biology that are relevant to evolution all the time. Hell, there's a journal that specifically only publishes papers that deal with the intersection of evolution and molecular biology, called, creatively, Molecular Biology and Evolution. They publish monthly and have done so since 1983, and that's just one of many biology journals that regularly publishes papers that wouldn't be possible if evolution were not true. So which is the good model? The one making new discoveries about how the world works all the time? Or the one that is essentially just a reactionary nuh-uh to all of the new discoveries that they don't like?
Even 20 years ago, it wasn't nearly as good as it is now.
The only new aspect of creationism that I am aware of in the last 20 years is the aforementioned soft tissue find.
I recommend people reading Replacing Darwin. It does replace the evolutionary model, and it's a really good explanation as to why that model is not good and ours is superior.
Nah, sorry. I looked at Jeanson trying to promote that book in a PureFlix interview, and he doesn't appear to have actually brought anything new to the table. He just put a new shade of lipstick on the old creationism pig.
You ask an evolutionist or an atheist, what is the meaning of life? Just ask them that. And they'll respond back with, well, my meaning of my life is whatever I make up.
I mean, that's a weird way to say it. I don't think anyone would phrase it as whatever I make up. It's usually more along the lines of, I get to decide that for myself.
What they're admitting is that they're making up, or make-believing, a purpose for life.
See? You have to purposely reword it in a way that most people wouldn't have phrased it in the first place in order to be able to draw your conclusions the way you want. It's not make-believe, it's about choice. I get to choose the purpose of my life, and I can change my mind about that choice should I decide to at any point. Right now, my life's purpose is to counter pseudoscientific nonsense from creationists. I don't need a god to tell me what to do, and being an eternal slave doesn't sound like a very fulfilling purpose anyway.
They don't think there actually is any purpose.
Well, which is it, Matt? Do we choose our purpose for ourselves, or is there no purpose? Those are not the same thing.
And so they say, well, I'll just make up purpose. That's make-believe, folks.
No, that's not make-believe, that's choice. If someone chooses to make helping the less fortunate their life's purpose, and then they go ahead and do a bunch of work to help the less fortunate, they have made a real, tangible difference in the world. Is that real, tangible difference make-believe? I mean, given the common Christian view of focusing on rewards in the afterlife to the exclusion of happiness or comfort in this life, it wouldn't surprise me if Matt was of the opinion that making a real difference in people's lives in the real world were a form of make-believe. After all, what's the point in making someone comfortable now if they're going to be suffering an eternity of torture later? Surely better to let them suffer now but inform them of how to escape the eternal torture later. Except, there's zero evidence for the eternal torture or the eternal paradise later. The life we have now is the only one that we have any evidence for. So, to someone who doesn't mindlessly accept your claims of an afterlife, letting people suffer for the sake of preserving a life that you can't demonstrate even exists seems cruel.
Why is it that some of the least religious places on Earth are so sad that they need to take antidepressants every single day?
Maybe atheists take their medication at a higher rate than religious extremists like you guys, because we don't stigmatize mental health and claim that if you are suffering from depression, it's something wrong with you, because if you were right with God, God would fix you. So there are fewer atheists who are in denial about the state of their mental health. Secondly, religion does actually appear to have a protective effect against depression, but what religion it is doesn't matter. Any religion will do. The conclusion there is that having a supportive community is important to mental health, more important than which god you believe in. Which is weird if there really is a specific god who won't heal you unless you believe specifically in him. So just imagine, will you, being someone with clinical depression, that is a real, measurable imbalance of chemicals in the brain that have an emotional impact. And that's a drastic oversimplification of what depression is. There's a lot more factors than just one or two chemicals being at too high or too low levels. Now imagine that such a person lives in a community that is very heavily religious. Lots of NIFB people running around preaching the hateful message that needing antidepressants is a sign of spiritual weakness. You know, the drugs that are designed to help correct the chemical imbalance in the brain, an imbalance the person doesn't have any control over? Now, do you think being stigmatized like that will have a positive or a negative effect on the person? Now imagine this same person, but in a community of people who obviously love them and are supportive to them, who encourage them to follow the advice of their doctor. Which one do you think feels better to the person with depression? Notice that for the second community, I didn't say anything about religion. Could be a more liberal church than the NIFB, could be an atheist group. It doesn't matter. Just belonging to a supportive community helps. It doesn't matter what religion or lack thereof that this community espouses. Rhetoric like what Matt is presenting here in his video leads directly to harm, and not just the harm of someone being sad. Harm like 100% preventable suicide. Mental health is an issue that doesn't have to be tied to atheism or evolution, so there is literally no reason for you guys to deny the science that has been done in treating mental health problems. There is no theological salvation issue surrounding mental health. This is just you guys being vindictive and cruel to a population of people who deserve respect and need science-based medical treatment to help them.
I would plead that is because without God, without a purpose in life, I think that man has to look at himself and say, what am I doing on this planet?
No, absolutely not. That is not the cause of depression. Faulty mood regulation in the brain, genetic vulnerability, neurotransmitter levels, improper functioning of nerve circuits, nerve cell connections and nerve cell growth, stress-related suppression of the production of new neurons in the hippocampus, and more are all factors that can potentially cause depression. What's more, the treatments for depression often have no immediate effect. There is evidence to suggest that depression is linked to a smaller hippocampus, and while antidepressants do immediately immediately affect the amount of various neurotransmitters, it takes time for the extra neurotransmitter stimulation to cause the development of new neurons in the hippocampus. Depression is a very complex topic, and each person has their own unique combination of factors that contribute to depression, which is why it is so important to treat depression with medical professionals who can tailor your treatment over time to be more personal and effective for you specifically. Telling people they just need to believe in God harder will not fix the actual medical problems going on in their brains. If anything, it will exacerbate them as they do everything they can to get God to heal them, and they don't get any actual healing and are expected by people like you to act as though they are healed. And since it's possible to hide depression, they may even tell you that they are healed when they are still in need of actual real medical care.
Then you wonder why so many people commit suicide.
Because assholes like you blame problems that they have no direct control over on them and tell them not to take their medications. And if you need to take medications, then there's something wrong with you that the medication can't fix. This is an incredibly harmful message.
All I know that exists is evil. So if everything is evil, I must be evil. I must be a product of evil.
Dude, you are a member of the religion that says everyone is born in sin, in evil. The atheists are saying that human beings have value and should be treated with at least a basic level of dignity and respect. Atheists are not the ones looking around and declaring everything to be evil. Isn't one of the main arguments that Christians use against atheists that they believe things that Christians think are evil to be good? Things like accepting people's sexuality without judgment, sex before marriage, sex education. Come to think of it, most of the things that Christians disagree with atheists about, morally speaking, are sex-related. Why does the all-powerful creator of the universe get so hung up about what I do with my penis? Doesn't he have more important things to worry about than my junk? Like, maybe he can stop worrying about people's private parts for long enough to, I don't know, maybe cure the pandemic that's having a significant negative global impact on people's lives right now? That'd be nice.
You know what foolishness is? Believing that we're related to monkeys and that we're also related to bananas and the grass at the same time. That's stupid. That's foolishness.
That's a demonstrable scientific fact. Is it intuitive? Absolutely not. But our intuitions are not helpful in science, never have been. That's why the whole scientific method is all about eliminating our intuition and biases from the equation.
There's many people that really believe that the Earth is millions of years old, and they really believe that they came from a dot that exploded magically out of nowhere.
There's many people who really believe that the Earth is less than 10,000 years old, and they really believe that they came from a dirt man and a rib woman who were magically made by a sky wizard. See, I can do it too. Do you know what the main difference is between your position and mine? Mine has evidence backing it up. Yours has a myth that was obviously stolen from the earlier Babylonian creation myths, including a lot of the same motifs, even a motif where the new god defeats the old god in battle. That's the whole Leviathan story, and there's an etymological connection between Leviathan and the chaos in Genesis 1, with Genesis 1 being an alternate story with God calming the chaos as being a representation of God triumphing over Tiamat. But I guess that's not the overly simplistic literal reading of the text that you guys like, is it? Heaven forbid we actually put some thought into our interpretation rather than just doing a surface-level analysis.
They just have no evidence to back it up. You know, dogs are still producing dogs, cats are still producing cats.
As is expected and predicted by evolution. Update your rebuttals a bit. You're attempting to make an argument against Linnaean classification rather than cladistic classification. It's not a good argument either way, but it betrays an obvious inability to at least know about recent science.
And, you know, obviously there's variations within kinds, but you'll never find an intermediate fossil because they just don't exist because it's just not true.
We have transitional nautiloids, ammonoids, cephalopods, insects, spiders, fish, tetrapods, amphibians, turtles, lizards, snakes, pterosaurs, birds, non-mammalian synapteds to mammals, artiodactyls to whales, horses, hominids, and a bunch more. Tell me again that they don't exist.
These people, like, it just goes to show they don't know the Bible.
Quite the contrary, getting to know the Bible is what caused me to stop being a Christian, because reading through the Bible makes it quite obvious that the God character is not someone that I want any dealings with, even if he does exist. And once I took off those rose-colored glasses, I realized that there wasn't any evidence that he does. I probably read the Bible more than most Christians do, even today. Do you know, I don't get Jehovah's Witnesses very often at my door, but when I do, I have never met a single one who knew about the Amalekite genocide. I'd have them turn to it in their own Bible that they brought with them, and not a single one that I talked to was previously aware of the all-loving God's command to the Israelites to slaughter all the people, old and young, infant and child. Sure, there are some spots in the Bible that I'm not overly familiar with. I don't think I've ever read through the Book of Lamentations, for example, but I'm likely to be familiar with any of the verses that your average Christian will be familiar with, and often I know the surrounding context that the Christians don't.
So, of course, they come at us when I bring these things up to them with the blanket statements that we've all heard a million times. They'll say, well, you know, must take a lot of faith there to think that a virgin could conceive there, buddy.
No, it takes zero faith to believe that. That's actually a key part of sex education. There is a myth that you can't get pregnant your first time having sex, but you can. So yes, a virgin can conceive, but she won't be a virgin anymore after that. And this is where Bible knowledge and context comes into play here, because in the New Testament, they use a Greek word that most definitely means virgin, but they are translating from a prophecy in the Old Testament, specifically Isaiah 7:14, in which a Hebrew word, alma, simply means young woman. It is also possible to infer from context that the word alma in that verse would be better translated as the concealed one, with reference to the Hebrew custom about the time it was written of a betrothed couple living in their parents' house, but keeping secluded from each other with a woman wearing a veil when they can't be secluded. But I will admit that a woman being a virgin is probably an implication of the word alma, as it is supposed to apply to a girl who can be married, and the ancient Hebrews considered non-virgins to be not marriageable, but the word alma could also apply to a woman right up until the birth of her first child, so after the sex but before the delivery. But that is all beside the point, because the prophecy, when read in context, is clearly not about Jesus. It was about King Ahaz of Judah being besieged by Ephraim and Syria in their attempt to pressure him into joining them in a coalition against the Neo-Assyrian Empire. The chapter starts with Ahaz being informed of the alliance between Ephraim and Syria, and being terrified of this alliance when they come to wage war in Jerusalem, but for some reason they can't attack, so they lay siege to the city instead. Then God offers a sign to Ahaz that a young woman will conceive and bear a son, name him Emmanuel, and before he knows how to refuse evil and choose good, the two kings that Ahaz fears won't be problems anymore. Since this all took place several hundred years before Jesus was born, it most definitely is not a prophecy about Jesus. It was fulfilled within King Ahaz's lifetime. But how many Christians know the context surrounding Isaiah 7:14? Not many, I'd wager, and judging by your comment on it here, you don't know it either.
You know what? These people think a rock conceived.
Nope. Not what anybody thinks.
You know, and one guy, I was in a debate a while ago with this guy, the raging atheist, and he goes, I don't know how anybody could have enough faith to believe that a Jewish man like Jesus would resurrect from the dead. And I'm just thinking, man, you think that every living cell came to life out of non-existence.
I very much doubt that that is exactly how the raging atheist phrased that. And your response is utter nonsense. Nobody thinks that every single cell came out of non-existence. Abiogenesis is merely the conclusion that, since life is essentially just a cascade of chemical interactions, and it gets simpler the farther back in time you go, the first life would have been very simple and would have been caused by a cascade of chemical interactions. It's really quite telling that your position is weak enough that you have to constantly grossly misrepresent what the so-called evolutionist position is on things like abiogenesis in order to make your point.
I believe Jesus died and resurrected. Jesus said, I have the power to lay down my life and I have the power to take it again into myself. And so Jesus had that power. But to say that you believe that every living life form resurrected from non-living material?
Dude, look up digestion sometime. That is literally a process that happens in your body all the time. You eat non-living material, your body breaks it down into its constituent non-living parts, and then it incorporates those non-living materials into your body. But what you are claiming with the resurrection of Jesus is that after the processes in the body that serve this function have stopped and have decayed for 3 days, that decay could magically reverse and kickstart these functions again, which, come to think of it, if Jesus was bodily resurrected and that restored the function of digestion, does that mean that Jesus still has to poop while he's in heaven? I know that sounds silly, but really, these are legitimate questions that are raised by the resurrection account. If Jesus was raised bodily from the dead, then his body needs sustenance. One of the natural conclusions of eating for sustenance is poop. Did Jesus stop eating and he's magically sustained, thereby eliminating the need for poop? Does he eat, but heavenly noses are retuned to make poop not smell gross? Where does heaven poop go? Is there a heavenly throne that flushes all the Jesus poop somewhere else? Does Jesus poop go to hell and smell extra bad down there as an added bit of torture? Another byproduct of digestion is gas. Does the bodily resurrected Jesus burp and fart?
That's crazy. That's madness. That's a greater resurrection than I believe in.
Nope, that's literally something that is observed all the time in regular bodily functions like digestion.
They want to talk about Christianity being a fairy tale and being a phony story, but look at what they believe. You have to have a lot more faith to be an atheist than you do to be a Christian.
If I grant that statement as true, which it's not, but if I grant it as being true, then that means that atheists are more virtuous than Christians, because the Bible treats faith as something virtuous to pursue. The more you have, the better. But of course, the statement isn't even close to true, so yeah, whatever.
Believing the gospel is easy. Believing that someone made everything here makes sense. But believing that a dot blew up and created everything, and two slugs crawled out of the primordial soup after it rained on the rocks for billions of years, married each other, and then made all the things that you see here, that's a fairy tale.
I refuse to believe that these people are actually stupid enough to think that we think that slugs were performing marriage ceremonies. Like, I know human reproduction outside of marriage is supposed to be bad and all, but do they think that animals get married? If not, why would they project that belief onto the godless heathens that they complain keep having sex outside of marriage? Or are you perhaps just being hyperbolic to make our position look worse than it actually is, because everyone knows that the idea of slugs performing marriage ceremonies is absurd? If that's the case, then that means you are purposefully misrepresenting our position to make it look worse than it is, which heavily implies that your position is incredibly weak and wouldn't be able to stand up to a comparison with what the so-called evolutionists actually believe. If it could, you wouldn't have to strawman our position, you'd just present it the way it is. So I'll take this as a win for evolution. And that's basically it. He does say stuff over the credits of his video that I could respond to if I wanted to, but it isn't anything that hasn't already been covered in this series. So the whole video that Matt titled The Atheist Religion was all just about evolution, abiogenesis, and cosmology, things that many Christians have no problem accepting and are not religious in any way. And Matt didn't even seem to be attempting to demonstrate that they were religious. I think Grady McMurtry called evolution a religion once, and that was the only time an attempt was made to connect the content of the video to the title. This was basically all just a rehashing of the same tired old talking points that Matt presented in Science Falsely So-Called. So I'm done with this one now. Now, I am going to be having Ethan on my channel on Sunday the 31st at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. We're going to be having a chat about his participation in this movie, whether he feels he was fairly represented, and whatever else he has going on right now. So look out for that. Today's comment of the day comes to us from Tyrann Estraza, who says, "Funny thing, free will, as defined by theologians, absolutely destroys the law of cause and effect as defined by the same theologians." Yeah, I'd never really thought about it from that perspective, but usually people like Matt want the law of cause and effect to essentially just be a big chain of causal links leading back to the moment of creation. But if that is the case, then that looks like it presupposes determinism. So sure, Matt, if you want the law of cause and effect to be a thing, I'll grant it for you, but now you've lost your free will, and so have I. So that means that every choice that I have ever made is a direct result of how God chose to create the universe, which means that God directly causes people to go to hell. It's not their choice to rebel against God, it's God's choice in how he made the universe. Thanks for watching. Special thanks as always to my patrons, Lynn Dobbs, Mark McManus, What Jesus, and all the rest, who are the food whose digestion results in the shit that is my channel. If you'd like to cause my gas, you can join us on Patreon for as little as a dollar per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino. If you feel so inclined, you can also support the channel through direct donation or my Amazon wishlist, which are linked in the description. If you'd like to listen to my videos in podcast form, the link for that is also in the description, as well as links to my social media accounts and my PO Box address. See you next time!